Imagine just navigating a typical high school hallway right between classes.
So complete chaos.
Right. Hundreds of kids flooding the space, people slamming metal lockers. You've got that blaring bell echoing off the concrete walls.
And usually those terrible flickering fluorescent lights overhead.
Yes. And for most students, I mean, that's just a Tuesday, you know? But imagine experiencing all of that with severe sensory sensitivities,
Overwhelming.
feeling actual physical pain from the noise, and having absolutely no way to tell someone that you are in a state of absolute emergency.
See, that right there completely changes our definition of a hazard.
It really does.
What might be just a minor annoyance to a neurotypical student can literally trigger a full-blown neurological crisis for another. And we often think of school safety as this, matter of engineering, locked doors, fire alarms, headcount protocol.
Right, structural stuff.
Exactly. But when you apply that purely structural model to a neurodivergent student, it just shatters. It doesn't hold up.
And that is exactly the reality we are unpacking today. Welcome to the deep dive, everyone.
Glad to be here to break this down.
So if you are, say, navigating the school system on behalf of an autistic child, or even if you're an educator trying to build a better environment, this one is for you.
Absolutely.
We are pulling together some really comprehensive research today, specifically looking at a guide by Angel Sense on autism school safety. We're zeroing in on monitoring tools, daily support systems, and those really dense institutional policies that kind of dictate how these kids survive their day.
Yeah, the bureaucracy of it all.
Our mission here is to distill exactly what makes a school truly prepared. Like, how can parents build a safety net that genuinely empowers a child rather than just restricting them?
Because the goal is really to look past those basic traditional safety measures. We need to synthesize the mechanics behind the strategies that actually work.
Right.
It's about understanding the root causes of these unique risks, so that parents can stop reacting to crises after they happen and start anticipating them instead.
Okay, let's unpack this because we should start with the risks themselves, which are, like we said, often completely invisible to the untrained eye.
Very true. They hide in plain sight.
And the source material highlights that even in states that have poured massive resources into public school support systems for autistic students, I mean, places like California or Florida,
Right, states with robust programs.
exactly, even there, parents are still hitting a wall. And the biggest, most persistent danger that just keeps coming up is wandering.
Yeah, wandering or elopement, as it's clinically called, is a terrifying reality for families.
I can't even imagine.
And there's this really stubborn misconception outside the autism community that a kid wandering off is just acting out.
Like they're just being defiant.
Exactly. It gets framed as disobedience or rebellion. But if you actually look at the neurological data, it is overwhelmingly driven by distraction, or much more often, it's a direct biological response to intense stress.
Wow. So if you view wandering as a behavioral issue, your instinct as an educator is to punish it, right?
Right.
You put them in detention.
Which does absolutely nothing to help.
Right. But if you understand it neurologically as a literal flight response, like an involuntary escape from sensory overload, your entire strategy has to change.
It fundamentally shifts the approach. I mean, think back to that hallway transition you just described.
Yeah, the concrete walls and the bells.
A sprawling public school campus is essentially just a giant maze of unpredictable variables. It's full of potential hiding spots, sudden loud noises, intense social pressures.
It's a minefield.
It really is. And when a student's nervous system registers that environment as an active threat, their brain bypasses logical decision-making entirely.
It just shuts down the logic.
Exactly. It goes straight into survival mode. They seek an escape route because their biology is telling them they are in danger.
Navigating a typical high school transition is honestly like merging onto a busy highway in the fog.
That is a perfect way to put it.
But like, if you have sensory sensitivities and you lack the communication skills to simply tap a teacher on the shoulder and say, "Hey, I am overwhelmed right now. I need to step out."
Right. If you can't self-advocate in that moment.
That traffic jam isn't just annoying anymore. It is an absolute emergency.
And the problem really compounds because in public schools, especially on large campuses, the staff-to-student ratio is rarely one-to-one.
Right. Teachers are stretched so thin.
Exactly. So a child trying to escape that noise might just slip out a side door, or they duck into a vacant stairwell to hide.
Oh, wow.
And a missing student might go unnoticed for a dangerous amount of time simply because the staff is spread across this massive area.
And there's a really heartbreaking reality to this too. Even for a relatively self-aware student who completely understands they are experiencing emotional distress,
yeah,
a lack of verbal communication skills in that precise moment prevents them from asking for a timely intervention. They're just trapped in their own panic.
Which is precisely why understanding the mechanism of these triggers is so vital. It shifts a parent's safety strategy from being strictly reactive.
Like organizing a search party after they're already gone.
Right, exactly. It shifts it from that to being highly proactive. The goal becomes anticipating the stress and providing an outlet before that flight response ever kicks in.
But just knowing the triggers isn't enough, is it? I mean, if sensory overload and panic directly cause the physical danger of wandering, our first line of defense actually has to be communication.
Absolutely. Safety is not only about calling 911 or building a higher perimeter fence around the playground.
Right.
It's about avoiding the meltdown entirely. If a child can clearly and efficiently express their needs before reaching their absolute breaking point, the physical risk plummets.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. We usually think of safety equipment as, I don't know, alarms or security cameras.
Reinforced glass, things like that.
Yeah. But according to this, a one-button photo dialer is actually life-saving gear.
What's fascinating here is that it acts as an emotional pressure valve.
Okay, tell me more about that.
Well, when we look at augmentative and alternative communication tools, you know, AAC devices, there's a really wide spectrum. On one end, you have these very complex tablets with highly detailed applications, folders, menus, all designed to help a nonverbal student build full, nuanced sentences.
Okay, but hold on. If we're talking about a kid in the middle of a literal panic response whose nervous system is screaming at them to run.
Yeah, they're in fight or flight.
Are they really going to be able to navigate through 3 submenus on an iPad to find the exact I am overwhelmed icon?
They almost certainly won't.
Right, that seems impossible.
The cognitive load required to operate a complex digital interface is simply way too high during an adrenaline spike.
Makes sense.
When a person enters a state of panic, the prefrontal cortex, which is the part of the brain responsible for logical processing and complex tasks, it essentially shuts down.
Wow.
Fine motor skills and executive function are severely compromised. You need something instantaneous. That is why simplified, specialized tools for emergencies are so heavily emphasized for school environments.
So what does an instantaneous tool actually look like in practice?
Wearable communication buttons are a prime example.
Like a physical button.
Yeah, it might be a small standalone device clipped to a belt or worn on a lanyard. And hitting one single button plays a loud, pre-recorded voice message of the student's name and their parents' phone number.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Or it might be a simplified calling system, something with just, say, 4 large photo buttons that send immediate clear messages, like, I need a break, or call mom.
So devices with no keypads, no scrolling menus, no passwords to type in.
The lack of a PIN or password is a subtle but absolutely critical design choice.
I wouldn't have even thought of that.
A password is a dangerous barrier to safety in a crisis. You see a picture of your dad, you press it, it calls your dad. Enabling a child to express their distress instantly mitigates the emotional escalation.
It stops it in its tracks.
Exactly. It interrupts the sequence of events before it ever turns into a physical hazard like wandering off.
Okay, this sounds amazing in theory, but here's where parents hit a massive, exhausting roadblock.
The human element.
Yes. What happens if a well-meaning but totally untrained teacher just looks at this photo dialer, assumes it's a toy, and confiscates it because they think it's a distraction?
Then your entire safety net vanishes in an instant.
Wow, just like that.
Just like that.
Yeah.
You can have the most advanced, streamlined communication device in the world, but if the institution's culture doesn't support it, it's completely useless. The human element is the single biggest variable in school safety.
So what does this all mean for parents? It sounds like you have to negotiate a legal treaty just to ensure your kid isn't punished for wearing headphones during a fire drill.
It is an immense amount of labor. Fighting an institution's culture is a really uphill battle.
I can only imagine how exhausting that is.
Teachers have to be more than just instructors, right?
Yeah.
They have to act as trusted mentors who are actually trained to spot the early physiological warning signs of stress.
Before the kid runs.
Exactly. And it extends far beyond the classroom walls. A truly prepared school has defined actionable supervision strategies for unstructured times.
Like recess or lunch.
Recess, class transitions, getting on and off the school buses. That's when most wandering happens.
What about the security guards?
Even the security officers. They shouldn't just be patrolling the halls looking for truants. They need to actually be familiar with the autistic students on campus.
Right, they need to know the kids.
They need to understand why a student might be lingering near an exit door rather than just yelling at them to get to class.
So how do parents actually mandate all of this?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this is where formalizing the safety plan becomes absolutely non-negotiable.
Okay.
Specifically through 504 plans and individualized education programs, which are commonly known as IEPs.
Let's clarify that, actually, because people throw those acronyms around constantly.
Yeah.
What is the functional legal difference when we're talking about securing these safety tools?
Broadly speaking, a 504 plan is designed to provide accommodations that ensure a student has equitable access to the learning environment.
Okay.
It removes barriers. So it might formally mandate that the student is allowed to wear those noise-canceling headphones without penalty.
Got it. And an IEP.
An IEP goes much, much deeper. It is a legally binding document between the family and the school district that dictates specialized instruction and related services.
So an IEP isn't just an academic learning plan. It literally functions as a legally enforceable safety and security document.
It does. If a wearable communication device, a GPS tracker, or a specific sensory break protocol is written into an IEP, the school is legally obligated to accommodate it.
That's huge.
And often, they're also obligated to train the staff on how to respond to those tools. Without that ironclad agreement, a substitute teacher stepping in for the day might entirely derail the safety protocol just because they weren't informed.
But negotiating an IEP can take months. You're sitting across a table from administrators who are, let's be honest, often constrained by really tight district budgets.
Always.
And you're trying to convince them to fund an extra paraprofessional or allow custom tech in the classroom.
Which is why many advocates suggest that sometimes the most efficient option isn't fighting an uphill battle to change an ingrained bureaucracy.
What's the alternative then?
Sometimes parents are better off actively seeking out a school whose pre-existing policies and stated ethics already align with supporting neurodivergent students.
What are the green flags parents should actually be looking for when they tour a school, though? Like, what are the telltale signs?
Well, visual schedules posted clearly on the walls are a big one. They drastically reduce the anxiety of the unknown for these kids.
That makes sense. What else?
Dedicated safe spaces for sensory regulation, meaning a kid has somewhere approved to go before they melt down. Low teacher-student ratios.
And let's be realistic here. A budget that reflects a true ability to afford adequate security and specialized support staff.
Yes, unfortunately.
A school administration can have the best intentions in the entire world, but if they are drastically underfunded, they simply won't have the personnel.
Safety costs money and requires manpower. That's just the reality.
Okay, but let's say the preventative measures fail. The sensory room is closed, the hallway's too chaotic, the child gets overwhelmed, the communication button gets dropped, and the understaffed school loses sight of them.
Nightmare scenario.
Right, and these wandering incidents happen the most during high chaos moments, right? Field trips, school assemblies, dismissal times.
Exactly. When that worst case scenario happens and an autistic child goes missing from the group, speed is everything.
Every second counts.
Every single passing minute expands the search radius exponentially and drastically increases the physical danger.
Which brings us to the ultimate fail-safe tracking technology. But if you just stick a standard smartphone or a basic Bluetooth tag in a kid's backpack, that doesn't really work if you're trying to find them hiding inside a massive multi-story concrete school building.
No, it really doesn't. Standard satellite GPS relies on a clear line of sight to the sky.
Right, like Google Maps.
Exactly. It struggles to penetrate thick roofs and concrete walls. And a frightened, overwhelmed child isn't going to go stand out in the middle of the open football field.
Where are they going to go?
They are going to hide inside the building, in a supply closet, under a stairwell, locked in a bathroom stall.
So how does the specialized tracking actually solve the indoor problem then?
A specialized tracker, like the ones highlighted in the Angel Sense guide, utilizes indoor Wi-Fi connectivity.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, it essentially stands for local Wi-Fi router networks within the school and uses their known locations to triangulate the child's position indoors.
That's incredibly smart.
It allows the staff to pinpoint them down to the specific hallway or room, even when the GPS satellites are completely blocked.
I'm also seeing a lot of emphasis in the research on AI-generated geofences. How does that differ from just, you know, pulling up an app and drawing a digital boundary around the school?
A standard geofence is static. You draw a circle, and if the device crosses the line, your phone pings. An AI-enhanced system is different. It can actually learn the child's specific routine over time.
Wow.
It understands when they are supposed to be in the cafeteria versus when they should be on the playground. It can trigger an automatic alert the very second they deviate from their expected schedule.
Or step one foot off the designated school grounds.
Exactly. And crucially, these systems allow location sharing directly with school staff, because the teacher is physically closer to the missing child than the parent who might be, you know, 20 miles away at work.
It's like installing a high-tech location sharing surveillance system on your kid.
It really is.
Sure, it tells you exactly where they are if they wander off a field trip, and some even have two-way voice communication so you can talk to them. But suddenly we have to worry about who else is looking at that data.
This raises an important question, right? Introducing powerful, real-time tracking technology into a public space creates a profound tension point around privacy.
Oh, massive.
Schools have a legal right, and really a moral obligation, to control the devices on their campus to protect the data of all the students.
Because a device that can, you know, listen in or track location continuously, that could potentially infringe on the privacy of the other 20 children in that classroom, or the teacher, for that matter.
Exactly. Families and schools are walking a really thin tightrope together here. You have this urgent, life-saving need for rapid emergency response on one side.
Right.
And the absolute mandate to protect student data and privacy on the other.
So where do they draw the line?
Well, what happens if a tracker has an open audio feed? Does that violate state wiretapping laws?
I didn't even think about that.
What happens if the location data is intercepted by a third party? Yeah. Parents must meticulously verify that these tech providers use strong end-to-end encryption and strict login permissions.
It's a huge trade-off.
And conversely, parents have to ensure the school itself has highly transparent consent guidelines before handing over tracking access to administrators.
So we've talked about strict, structured supervision. We've talked about ironclad legal IEP agreements, Wi-Fi triangulation, and AI surveillance.
It's a lot of intervention.
It is.
Yeah.
And it brings up a really glaring contradiction. How in the world is a heavily monitored, heavily tracked child ever supposed to learn how to navigate the world on their own?
Well, they have to. That is the ultimate goal of all of this.
Mm.
Fading the tech. Yes. Safety measures must be designed to support a child's growth, not permanently restrict it.
Yeah.
If we just wrap a child in physical and digital bubble wrap forever, they never learn to self-regulate or navigate rough terrain.
So it's a stepping stone.
The goal is scaffolded independence.
It sounds less like we are putting them in a straitjacket and more like we are giving them a trapeze safety net.
I love that analogy.
Right. Okay. Like the net is only there so the acrobat feels secure enough to take risks and learn new flips. You don't perform the routine in the net. It just lets you fly without the paralyzing fear of falling.
That is the ideal roadmap to autonomy right there. You don't jump from 24/7 monitoring to zero monitoring overnight.
Right.
You start with that close supervision and those simple single-button communication tools we discussed. Then, as the student builds skills and self-awareness, you progress to wearable check-ins.
Just letting them test the waters a bit?
Yes. A student might be allowed to navigate a short transition, say, walking from the math classroom to the library completely independently.
Because they know the net is there.
Exactly. They know the wearable device is there if they get overwhelmed, and the staff knows they can find them if they don't arrive in 5 minutes. Eventually, they participate in unstructured activities with staff just monitoring from a distance rather than holding their hand the entire time.
Wow. So true school safety is fundamentally about coordination.
100%.
When the tracking tech, the highly trained staff, and the structured daily routines all align properly, they actually fade into the background.
They do.
They become invisible, allowing the child to step forward, explore their surroundings, and build genuine confidence.
It completely reframes the entire concept of protection.
It really does. I mean, we started today by realizing that standard safety, the locked doors and fire alarms, completely fails to address the invisible hazards of sensory overload and stress-induced wandering.
We really covered a lot of ground.
We did. We explored how proactive communication tools act as emotional pressure valves and the sheer bureaucratic effort it takes to legally secure those tools through IEPs.
And we examine the reality of relying on high-tech fail-safes, things like Wi-Fi tracking and AI geofencing.
Right, trying to balance that desperate need for physical safety against the ethical complexities of privacy.
All of it working together.
All in the name of building a support network that hopes to one day make itself obsolete. Which, I think, leaves us with a lingering thought for you to ponder. If modern technology and AI allow us to seamlessly track and monitor a child's every move to keep them perfectly safe, how will you know when the safety net is actually holding them back and when it's finally time to turn the tracker off?
A very profound question for a lifelong journey.
Truly. The next time you picture school safety, don't just think about the visible locked doors. Think about the invisible net, waiting there, ready to catch them when they fall, but always hoping they learn to fly. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We'll catch you next time.